This is Mental Selling. This is the sales podcast for people that are dedicated to making a difference in customers' lives and have a purpose beyond just a paycheck. I'm your host, Will Milano. Let's get right into the show. When a sales organization succeeds, it's because everyone on the team knows what to do and why they do it. They have purpose. The team is working in ways that bring the company's mission, vision, and values to life and build trust. And they have leaders that lead with courage, compassion, and that same sense of purpose. I'm pleased to be joined today by John Baldoni, an internationally recognized keynote speaker and author, and an expert on what it takes to lead with compassion, commitment, and courage. John provides performance-based consulting that leverages positive behavior change, enables individuals to lead more purposefully, and with greater grace under pressure. Thinkers 360, Global Gurus, and Inc.com have all recognized John for his thought leadership and expertise in coaching, leadership, and management. John, thanks so much for being with me today.
Well, Will, thank you for that kind invitation, and I appreciate the warm welcome.
I want to start with something I just talked about in the introduction, and it's around this idea that organizations all have visions, stated missions, values, which is great. But how do those come to life and, more importantly, stay at the forefront of how people act and make decisions on a daily basis?
Well, Will, you know as well as I do that the way to make your mission, vision, and values work is to put them on posters and put them in the office. And that way, they are guaranteed to work because every office you go into, you will find those mission, vision, and value statements. So just put them on a placard and put them on the wall. Doesn't that work, Will?
Yeah, exactly. And then the rest just happens through osmosis, right? And on your website too, right?
On the website too. Well, actually, it's a very good question because, well, we'll use the phrase, live the mission, live the vision, live the values, okay? That means you really live it, you know, and you act like it. Your behaviors reinforce it. And it's up to the leadership team to certainly live the values for behavior and competence and those kinds of things, but they need to reinforce the vision. And I like to say vision is our sense of becoming, and maybe we'll never, ever be there, but we will be working toward our mission is what we do. And so that's where the clarity in your strategies come from, you know, to make sure that what we do and our strategies and our tactics are reinforce our mission. And, you know, a lot of organizations sometimes get distracted by the bright, shiny object. And we all do. I mean, you know, we're kind of like dogs at times chasing squirrels. So that might be good for a dog, but it's not good for an organization. So you need to be laser focused on what it is you do. And if you're going to make a change, and businesses do change all the time, make it clear and communicate that clearly to the team. Not once, not twice, but 100 times. So everybody knows is on the same page. Never assume everybody understands. And that's where we always want to check for understanding. Tell me what I told you. That's a bedrock of military communication. Tell me what I told you. So the brief back. So that's how you begin to drill this stuff. But most importantly, it starts with the behavior, the outlook. Do leaders communicate it to their customers? Do they communicate it to the stakeholders? Do they communicate it to the team? And that's what's important. And at times it can be repetitious for the person on the top. Of course, it's repetitious, but that's purposeful.
There's several things that you write and talk about that I found so relevant for inviting you on the show and for our audience. Let's talk about one, which is focusing on better. You've written that, quote, "We cannot control events or circumstances, but we can control how we react to them and how we move forward through them." Sales can feel sort of like an all or nothing role. You win a deal or you don't. You win a customer or you lose it. How can you focus on being better during some of like inevitable highs and lows that come with the job?
That's a very good question. And I'll tell you the little backstory about finding focus on better. It's dual. I came across a tweet, I think it was maybe on New Year's Day or shortly, by Amy Cuddy, who writes on leadership presence. And she talked about something about better. But I also dovetailed it with a show of BBC drama or comedy called 1A, which was really a send-up of the BBC. And one of the characters in the show had the title Director of Better. And no one, of course, could define what better meant. So it was a tongue-in-cheek laughing at at our organizational culture in a way. But really, and getting back to the resolutions, we all formed, or many of us do New Year's resolutions, but you know, do we hold them past January 15th? Nah. So my goal with focus on better is define what better means to you in relation to your work, your colleagues, your spouse, your family. So in particularly in sales, so how could I be a better salesperson? How can I serve this customer better? How could I be a better communicator? How could I be a better listener? How could I be a better service provider? And work on those things. And I think the fact that if you are put it in sales is a great method for this, because salespeople are so very many. The good ones are all detail oriented and very focused on service. So if you itemize, what can I do for Will or what can I do for Sally? That's on being better for each of them in my own way. It helps give you a focus. And as you said, the highs and lows, you may win a deal, may lose a deal, may not get all of a deal, whatever it is, how can I do it better the next time? Or maybe say, you know, customer ABC is really not worth my time and effort. I'm going to go to customer F and try something different. So
that's a really good articulation, because you're talking about sort of like looking forward and focusing on all the activities and specific behaviors and things like that that will lead you to your goals. But then also you pointed out sort of the reflection of like, how can I be better based on what I've done? And I think a lot of times salespeople don't spend enough time reflecting and looking back on what they did previously and how they can build upon that.
You know, that's a really good question, Will. And why? Because they're not, well, I say it, not incentivized. So the deal went south, so let's toss out the thing. Well, maybe it went south for one little detail, not just price, but something else, something beyond their control, or maybe they dropped the ball. Diagnose what went right or what went wrong, and how can I re-pitch the deal or learn from the next time? So we all learn from our failures and our mistakes. And so the next time you pitch a customer, you will do something differently. You may do something differently. Or the next time you're closing a sale, you may do something differently. So that's the whole thing. It's continuous learning. That's very easy for me to say, but if we take the time to reflect on it, and we don't, our culture is such that we're moving ahead at light speed, which is good in some ways, but it means we don't take the time to reflect. Our culture doesn't really take that time. I know good salespeople take time out on a regular basis. What's going on with my customer? What do I do with that? As part of it is keeping in touch with your customer, listening to what they have to say. And that's part of your reflection process. And then taking it to, there, maybe there's another offering, another service you could provide, whatever it is. That's the approach.
Yeah, I think that point you made about, you know, being better as a focus on continuous learning really matters quite a bit. Building trust with customers and colleagues is such an essential aspect of succeeding in sales. What are some of the factors that you think most build trust and help you become that person that everyone wants to work with and will recommend you to others?
Well, are you saying, Will, that it's not enough to say, trust me?
Right.
It comes down to behavior. And behavior meaning, am I listening? Am I responding? Do I do things in a timely fashion? Am I competitive in service and in pricing? And am I truthful? I mean, am I delivering on time? Does the product warrant what we say about it? Are the features and benefits real? And, you know, so often salespeople will win me over and say, you know, we say X product will do this. That's not really its strength. It's really good for XYZ. That builds trust. And because the customer or the salesperson is laying it on the line for you. The other day, my wife and I we have downsized from a house of 33 years to a condo. And so we've been doing a lot of purchasing, and we had to do some, you know, small carpeting area. And we had a young salesperson, and we were looking over the things, and we asked him a question, or I didn't, my wife did, of course. And the young man did not know the answer, but he said, you know, let me go ask Al. He's been doing this for 30 years. He knows the answer to that. He pulls him over and does that. And I went up to the young man. I said, you are a good salesperson. You admitted what you didn't know, and you got help right then and there. So that's a real positive.
Yeah, that's a big fact. So many salespeople are afraid to admit that they don't know something when the most important aspect of it, and you just articulated, is I don't know it, but I will find out for you and get the answer for you. Because that's what the person wants. That's what the buyer wants. Now, on grace, you've written several books on the topic, like most recently, it's called Grace Under Pressure. And having grace under pressure is something that I think is really important for sales teams. How can their leaders demonstrate resilience in the face of, you know, adversity, their ability to provide clarity in times of uncertainty, deliver hope, optimism in the face of fear, all those things?
That's a great question. Grace, I consider the catalyst for the greater good. So it's whatever we do to make our world better. It fundamentally rests upon connection. You to me, you to your colleagues, friends, family, all of that. And with connection, we build community. And I think what we're all looking for is a sense of belonging. So taking a step back about what grace under pressure is, that ability to act truthfully and honestly and with composure when all hell is breaking loose. Now that phrase came from Ernest Hemingway in a letter he wrote to a fellow author, Dorothy Parker, in the 1920s. It came to light by Ted Sorensen, who was working with then Senator John Kennedy on his book, Profiles in Courage. And both Hemingway and Kennedy defined it as courage. And so I think that's part of what it is too. Now, how you manifest it is you keep calm, you keep composed. And I always like to draw an analogy with the 5-alarm fire. When you see it, there's a lot of heat, there's a lot of noise and chaos. Often the most calm people on the scene would be the battalion fire commander. He or she has to keep it together, because if they don't, then things fall apart. And that doesn't mean that they're not feeling fear and they're not manifesting the danger of the situations. It means they're projecting this calm composure, because that's what the team needs. So most often salespeople aren't going to be in that kind of situation, but not to be dismissive, the day-to-day grind of doing the work, and we have adversity, we have defeats, we don't close a deal, we lose a customer, all those things, those cause friction on the system. And so how you maintain your composure, how you maintain your attitude and your demeanor is important. Also, part of that is how you project a sense of optimism. We'll get it the next time. And it's not happy talk. And you'll say, we'll get it the next time. And then people will go, well, how are we going to do that, boss? They'll go, well, I got some ideas and we're going to have a meeting on it or whatever it is. But give somebody tactical things to hold on to and build and solicit input from others. That's the way you act with grace under pressure. And we're all going to face it. The subtitle of the book, Grace Under Pressure, is Leading Through Change and Crisis. So we're always going to be facing change, and eventually we'll be facing crises. So it's important for leaders to, you know, take care of their people, focus on them, take care of themselves too, and prepare for the future. So those are the things you do when things are coming apart at the seams.
That idea ties back to the trust issue that we were talking about earlier, because displaying a sense of composure, sense of optimism, and that's whether you're a sales leader with your team or you're a salesperson with your customer, all those things sort of, they create that calm and reassurance, right? That is so essential to creating trust.
Trust is earned, and it's earned through example, and it's earned through adversity. And you think about, what is the adage that a problem corrected in a sales with a customer will gain you more than a satisfied customer, that kind of thing. So when you earn your trust, particularly in times of hardship or in times of adversity, you build something we call resilience. Okay. And resilience is like a muscle. The more you use it, the stronger it becomes. But inherent in the sense of resilience is also this thing, strength. It's not simply bending and not breaking. I used to define it as that, but it's more than that. It's really transformation, because when you suffer, experience it in adversity, and you recover from it, you will come back stronger. If you pay attention, you'll come back wiser. You will do it differently the next time. The same old isn't going to work. We have to adjust, because that's the nature of life.
Yeah, that was the idea of benefits of adversity and building resilience was actually the next thing I wanted to ask you about. I know you've talked about things like building resilience is in part by focusing on like what you can control and then going back to like that clarity of purpose, right? Those sorts of things, those all feed into being a more resilient person.
Any leader is wise to understand the power of adversity. An executive coach, I do work with senior leaders. That's what my practice is limited to these days, but it's dollars to donuts. Every single one of them has experienced a moment of truth where a senior boss or their boss or a trusted person came over and said, you know, Will, you're doing a really good job. But if you keep on doing this, you're going to end up out of this company sooner than you think. And usually that something is trying to do it all myself, being a know-it-all, not delegating, simple things that we learn, not simple things, but things we learn with experience and time. That's a moment of adversity. Those people that succeed are those who have experienced it and get better at it. And so that's what managers need to do, is that when people make mistakes, don't throw out, if it's an ethical transaction, well, that's another matter. But simple mistake with a customer, misinformation, whatever it is, that kind of stuff, use it as a teachable moment. I think failure is maybe our best teacher, not just a good teacher, maybe our best teacher. And so leverage that example. And there's a wonderful story that I've told and written about that and comes from Charles Alaki, many years headed JPL, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. And they had two missions to Mars, and both of them were back-to-back craft-ups. And some of the two project managers, I can imagine them sheepishly walking into Alaki's office and handing in their resignations. And Alaki looked at him and he goes, gentlemen, why would I fire you? I just spent $10 million educating you. So go back and do it. And of course, we've had many successful missions to Mars since that time. So that's a big example. But it's the kind of thing that every boss can do when they see mistakes. Now, if someone's not competent in their role, that's another matter. But you know, well-intentioned people who have the goods to make it, well, then they need education like all of us do.
Yeah, displaying that sort of confidence in people, even in the face of failures, it creates that culture where the person's going to want to go to bat for the leader.
Absolutely. And that's a form of trust because, you know, in my moment of need, Will stood by me. I'm going to have his back. That's trust.
You wrote a great piece last summer that I read for Smart Brief around three key words that form the foundation of what we want leaders to demonstrate. And what was interesting is none of them had anything to do in particular with skills or acumen. Do you remember that? Can you share that? The three key areas were, it was integrity, intellect, and inclusion. And I thought that was really profound.
Yeah. You have to have the smarts. You have to be ethical. And I think an important part is inclusive. I mean, we can be smart and we can be clever, and that's fine if we're a solopreneur or working and by ourselves. But if I'm a leader, a team leader, I need to bring out the best in everybody else. So I need to be inclusive. I need to bring people in. I need to bring people in who are different from myself. Groupthink is led by people all thinking the same way, and organizations get themselves stuck in that kind of rut. And, you know, well, I like to hire this kind of person. Well, that's okay. But too many of this kind of person means everybody's that kind of person. And you get totally blindsided when something new and different happens. Well, then circumstances change. So
for sales leaders, the coaching and the guidance that they provide, they play such an essential role in a salesperson's success. And you've emphasized that the importance of leading with courage and compassion and, you know, again, this idea of leading and coaching with purpose. Can you talk some more about that?
I think purpose is the why. Simon Sinek has said, and others have said that, and it's what fuels us. But knowing is, how am I going to contribute to the vision of the organization? And what kind of people do we want representing us? And it's up to the sales manager to exemplify that. But it's also, again, what I've been talking about is, and I'm glad you brought up the idea of coaching, because I think a sales manager's role really is to coach. And I think, frankly, every manager, not just sales managers, but I think in particular, a sales manager can have great influence by listening and then saying, hey, I need you to do X, or let's focus on this and what you can do better, what your strengths are, what you need to improve on, all of these kinds of things. And, you know, sometimes people need more coaching than others, but coaching should always be timely, related to the situation. I think ideally coaching is an ongoing process, but if an issue arises, you want to address it immediately before it becomes an issue. So, and that's where the coaching gets involved, having established a relationship. So,
yeah, that's a great point. Just like training salespeople, coaching is not a check the box activity. You don't do it once or once a year or whatever, and it's done. I think, you know, something else that we always see around coaching is the idea that so many sales leaders mistake managing and reviewing numbers and pipeline and to-do lists. They think that that's coaching and that's managing, and that's an important piece of it, but it's far different from what you're talking about what coaching entails.
Coaching is developmental, and sometimes it's remedial in the sense that this is what I need you to improve on. But often the greatest thing of coaching is that it's aspirational or developmental, so you can become better at what you do.
Just about every sales leader transitions into the role from being a very successful individual contributor. I wonder what your perspective is on why you think connecting with their teams and building trust is so hard for new sales leaders, when that's exactly what they had to do with customers and peers in building their careers as individual salespeople.
That's a really good question, Will. I've never heard it phrased like that, but it reminds me of a story. I was called in to coach someone who was, I think was a kind of a salesperson who had a sort of a gruff demeanor toward colleagues. But it came out in conversation with HR that this particular person was great with customers. He said the most giving, you know, person and educational and patient and all the things he was with the customer, he was not with his own people. So in my first session with him, I think this was like a magical moment in coaching. I still remember it. I phrased that to him and I said, why don't you think of your colleagues as your customers? Because that's what they are. And I could literally see the light go on in his brain. He goes, ah, and it was, coaching was over. Boom, like that. He got it. He knew exactly what he needed to do. So perhaps it's that mindset of, I'm not with my customers, but my salespeople, they become my customers. But in fairness, Will, you have to understand, is this what I want? Okay. There is a great, I call it long-term, short-term goals. When you're, say, a salesperson or maybe an accountant, base level, whatever, not base level, but entry level, you have your to-do list and over time. So you're working on a five-day format, whatever, 30-day, whatever. When you're in management, you're working on 30-day, 90-day, 100-day, a year platform. Where's the juice? Where's the energy? You know, if you are doing a good job as a salesperson, you're getting a pat on the back. You're getting affirmation regularly. When you're in management, you're getting beat up from below and from the top. So it takes a special kind of mindset. So not every salesperson should be in management, but those who do have to commit to this management and leadership mindset. So you have to have the will to do it. But if you're in that position and maybe you're having a tough time collecting with them, look at them as your customers. And how would I treat that customer? What would I do with that? So that doesn't mean you have to be buddy-buddy by any means, not that. And that's often where problems come, because if you're promoted from the sales force, you're managing your buddies, and that's really, really hard. So you have to distance yourself.
You know, it's a great point. And just like sort of being in sales, it's about not just the skill, but the will and the why. And you're right, for any salesperson, if they've been in the role for 5 years or 25 years, they've got to self-examine when the opportunity arises to get into a leadership role. Do I have the passion around this? Is this really what I want to do? Because the reality is, as you just said, it's a fundamentally different job. And it's okay to say no, that's not what where your passion lies, right? Yeah.
I know, I'm sure you do too. Yeah. Many people who were in sales management just said, you know, I'm better in the field, or I want to do this. And all power to them and give them credit for recognizing it. And when they go back in the field, they might even be better.
Right. And, that's true. We talked more recently on our show about the emergence of sales teams needing to operate more just as that, a team versus solo selling efforts. What are some ways to help your team have more reasons to believe in themselves and have trust in each other collectively as a group so that they're operating more in that way?
Well, part of that, obviously, may come down to compensation. So in the sense of how am I being evaluated? If I'm evaluated by the numbers that I make, that's one thing. If I'm evaluated by the numbers I make and the team makes, that's a different incentive, shall we say. So then I have a financial motivation to pitch in. A way around what I was kind of thinking about this before is a lot of organizations team senior salespeople with junior salespeople. And that's a way of grooming the next generation, but also learning from them. But it's up to the manager to make it clear who has the expertise, what you can learn from them. And so that make it known that the senior person is mentoring this more junior person, that they're compensated for that. They're recognized for that. And so that's part of their job too. So I think it's pay for what you're asking people to do. As far as the team ethos, then it's the commitment to the standard things that all of us do on a team is what's our mission and what are our values? And do we exemplify them? And if we don't, well, then that's going to be an issue. So that needs corrective, you know, needs counseling, coaching, or a kick up the backside at times. So, but it can be hard to build a team ethos of essentially individual contributors. So then it's up to the manager to understand who's more collaborative than others and leverage that. Leverage what you can. You're not going to make a team player from somebody who doesn't want to be a team player. And if the organization can succeed with a superstar salesperson who prefers to work alone, and I'm not talking about being one who is not doesn't share the ethos of the team, but is just better working by him or herself, well, then can we work on that? How can we do that? Make it work. So give each person a kind of role that suits them best when possible.
And I think it also ties back to sort of the mission, vision, and values that we kicked off the discussion with, which is if as an organization, your mission, vision, values is all about doing right by the customer, doing the absolute best for that customer. If that then is best done by bringing sort of collective wisdom and collective efforts to the table, then you have that obligation to work together.
And also sometimes there's the addition by subtraction method. And I'm talking about the superstar salesperson who's toxic, who burns bridges, and that maybe makes the numbers or superstar numbers, but is not healthy for the organization. That person needs to change their ways. And if they don't, then they can no longer be part of the team. And when that happens, the rest of the salespeople go, oh, you're really walking the talk. You know, so.
Well, John, I want to thank you so much for being with us today. I've wanted to have you on the show for a while, and I think everybody listening can hear why now. So I think this has been really great and really great insights for our audience. So thank you again for taking time to be here.
Well, great. Will, you ask great questions. I love these questions, and you made me think, and I appreciate it. And you even challenged my memory.
Thank you. I appreciate it. For listeners, you can find and follow John Baldoni on LinkedIn, also on X at John Baldoni. Also catch his LinkedIn Live's Grace Under Pressure interview series. His website is johnbaldoni.com. And be sure to check out John's books, including the latest in his Grace trilogy called Grace Under Pressure. Thank you to everyone, as always, for listening wherever and whenever you might be hearing this. Be sure to follow the show if you're not already. Go back and catch up on any previous episodes that you might have missed. And of course, please tell your colleagues and friends about the show. Benefit from listening, and we look forward to having you with us again next time. Thanks, everyone. Thank you for listening, and I really hope you've enjoyed this episode of Mental Selling. Please make sure that you're subscribed, and as always, leave us a comment or a rating. Share it with your networks. You'll get more content like this on our website at integritysolutions.com. Until next time, I'm Will Milano with Integrity Solutions. Thanks very much again for being with us.